Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Wisconsin is our destination today as I welcome citizen folklorist and historian and the driving force behind Badgerland Legends, Jeff Finnup. Jeff's brand new book, Wisconsin Legends for Kids, is a brilliant introduction to some of the state's most notable lore for eager and inquisitive younger minds. Jeff and I discuss the book along with a couple of other residents of the Badger State that couldn't be included. A big thank you to Jeff for joining me on this week's show. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to my latest patron, Auntie. Welcome to the team, and thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support me and the show with your patron contributions. It is greatly appreciated. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can also find the mysteriesandmonsters.com website, where you can find news and episodes. Our exclusive merchandise store is available through TeePublic, and you can click the link there for the show note. Nothing better than a Mysteries and Monsters t-shirt to hit the beach in this summer, everyone. Our intro and outro music are provided by the incredible Weary Pines. Thank you, as always, to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So let's head to Wisconsin to meet some mastodons, serial killers, ghost chickens, and of course, a dogman or two. The Badger State is our destination today, as we go on the search for some of its strangest stories. Acting as our guide to these tales is citizen historian, folklorist, and creator of the Badgerlands legends, Jeff Finnup. His book, Wisconsin Legends for Kids, is out now, ready to inspire the next generation to search out the strange. Jeff, I'm delighted to finally welcome you and be able to speak to you in person, sir.
Thank you, Paul. Honored to be here, and thanks for the wonderful introduction.
You are very welcome. You are very welcome. As we were joking before we started, this seems a bit strange because we've kind of got to know each other fairly well over the last 5 or 6 years, and we've chatted a lot through the medium of social media, but this is our first proper conversation.
Yeah, and it's great it's finally happened. I'm happy to sit down and tell you a little bit more about my journey.
Absolutely. I'm delighted to hear about it and learn more. And congratulations on being my 300th guest from Wisconsin.
Yeah, there is many Wisconsin luminaries that came before me on this podcast, and I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, well, I'm very humbled and honored as well, Jeff, that you anointed me as an honorary Wisconsinite several years ago. So it's nice to be finally speaking to the person that bestowed that honor upon me.
Yeah, and as Paul told me, he is a honorary Wisconsinite, and he considers Wisconsin his spiritual homeland.
Yeah, just don't try make me follow your NFL team. I'll be all right.
Go Pack, go.
Hey, you know, I've got one of my best mates over here is a big Pack fan. So I've kind of got a soft spot, but my team have been crap for 30 years, so I'm not going to worry about anything. Well, hopefully we've got a new horizon coming. But being a Commanders fan since 1983, I am used to false dawns, Jeff.
You had a couple good years there in the Mark Rippon era.
Yes, yes, yes. Doug Williams and other such luminaries throughout that. It's one of my favorite childhood memories is staying up to watch them win the Super Bowl against the Broncos back in 1988.
Well, yeah, and I wish the Packers would have beat the Broncos in 1997. So
yes, yes, yes.
At least
yes.
Your team got it done.
Yeah, well, at least you've won this century, which is more than
That's
we
right.
can say for us. But anyway, enough of boring everybody else about our NFL addictions. Jeff, here we are. You are someone that's built a reputation as a collector and collator of some of the wonderful and unusual stories in your homeland. I'm often intrigued to discover what inspired people at a young age. For some, it's a book, it's a relative, it's a TV show. So for a young chap growing up in Wisconsin, Jeff, what pulled you into the weird? How did you find yourself following this path the rest of your life?
Yeah, it's funny that you asked that because the inscription in the book, right before the introduction, I pulled a quote. And the quote is from a dusty old book. My mom, she just brought it home from the library one day, the local public library. And it was this kind of black and blue weird cover on it. And it said, Wisconsin lore. And the quote in that book that really captured my imagination as a child of about 8 was, Wisconsin contains, if the yarns are any indication, more ghosts per square mile than any other state in the nation. Now, I'm not sure how that is scientifically verified, but at 8, I didn't care.
Yeah.
I knew that at least I was living in a spooky place, and it kind of sent a shiver up my spine and kind of intrigued me to look further. And my mom told me stories of her dad back in the day driving by an old farmhouse near the farm where he grew up and worked, where there were – this was long before the time of electrified lighting, where there was a bright shining light coming through this house. And that always kind of enchanted me as a young age. And then I was the kid going to the Catholic school library. I was grabbing all the books on vampires, werewolves, ghosts, UFO phenomenons. This was about the time where the crop circle flaps were coming out. All the Time Life books were coming out. And luckily, I was of the age when the X-Files were coming out, Unsolved Mysteries. So that really captured me at a young age. And long before the paranormal reality shows that are prevalent today. But I got in early and got hooked, especially from that book. So I decided to put that right on the inscription inside the book.
Yeah, it's a perfect quote, really, because I think one of the things that often surprises me as someone that grew up throughout the 70s and 80s is that I don't know whether we look back at the past sometimes, Jeff, with rose-tinted glasses, but it seemed to me back then it was easier for kids to find books about ghosts and UFOs and Bigfoot and things, even here in the UK, than it is these days. It seems very, I know recently, this book included, there seems to be a real sort of drive from the new generation of lovers of the weird and wonderful to try and bridge that gap. Because I think, I'm not really sure if the perception is that these subjects are too scary for kids, but I think for a lot of us, we all grew up reading scary stories, be they fictional or true, Jeff, from all over the world, sometimes under the covers with a torch or whatever when we were kids growing up. And I think there seems to have gone this gap seems to have appeared for better or for worse. Whereas, like I say, this book is one of two or three over the last year or so that I've seen as being primarily aimed at that sort of pre-high school age where these kids are thirsty for knowledge. And when I was that age, I couldn't get enough of strange stories about these things.
Yeah, and it seemed like you're right. There definitely was a gap there. And seeing the many luminaries coming from Wisconsin, like Chad Lewis and Linda Godfrey, that there wasn't a title specifically directed towards kids. And, you know, like I said, with my story, you know, being 8 and having my mom bring home that title. And that was definitely more of a an adult title, but for me to kind of dive in and thumb through it and read some of the spooky stories from my land, I kind of wanted to do the same with this book to get the younger readers to come in and see, you know, maybe they're not from Wisconsin, maybe they're from a different part of the country, but to really look into their backyard to see what kind of creepy crawlies and ghost stories or local lore, you know, haunts their region of wherever they live.
Yeah. So, I mean, was this a driving influence in pulling this book together? Because I know that obviously you like to share some of these stories with your children, Jeff. Mm-hmm. Was it your children that kind of pushed you into pulling something together, or was it something that you thought, I just want to create something for my children and their friends to move forwards with?
It was really my daughter on our walks to school. She knew that I wrote about spooky tales, and I'd also, you know, often recount the tales of the Palmyra worm shower or this flood of frogs that appeared on the lake shores of Lake Michigan in the 50s, and just some of the more bizarre kind of Fortean aspects of Wisconsin, you know, not trying to really scare her, but just trying to enchant her with wonder. So the dedication was to her and her little brother, who's Isla's actually turning 7 today. So happy birthday, Isla. Aww. And her little brother, Ian, he's 4 going on 5. So he'll soon kind of grasp the wonders that I wrote in the book. So I really wrote it for her, kind of behind her back. I looked through a lot of my Instagram posts and Facebook posts and kind of curated the most child-friendly aspects of the Wisconsin legends and decided to put them in a book for her. And I ended up going on Kindle Direct Publishing, which is a great service, and printing out the proof copy and sliding under her pillow for her to discover, and having her find that and bring it down and say, "Oh my God, Daddy, you wrote this book." You know, that was a real driver behind that, was kind of trying to see the wonder in this stuff through my daughter's eyes again.
Mm. Oh, I bet that was marvelous. I mean, who would you sort of lay the blame at? I mean, you can't sort of say it's the Tooth Fairy that's delivered it, Jeff. I mean, did you sort of rent a Pugwudgie to do that?
Now, that would have been a great wrinkle if I would have denied it. But yeah, I fessed up to it pretty quickly, and she was tickled to see it and thumb through it and, you know, either read the legends for herself or have me tell her during bedtime stories. So she was excited nonetheless.
Yeah. Well, I suppose that for me, I would imagine, Jeff, when you're looking at what to put in this book, would probably be the hardest part, because Wisconsin has a very varied history of strange and weird things, as well as some very dark incidents in its past. I mean, two of North America's most notorious serial killers, or well, one was perhaps more of a strange person more than a serial killer, but one was very much a serial killer with Ed Gein and Jeffrey Dahmer, which kind of bookend the sort of beginning and exposure of the serial killer outbreak, as it were. Dahmer's obviously very well known, probably one of the most famous, I would imagine, in the last 40 or 50 years, Jeff.
Yeah, I'd have to say that he, you know, if there was a Mount Rushmore of serial killers in America, he would definitely be on top of that. And then you mentioned Gein as well, who was more of a grave robber. They call him the Wisconsin Ghoul.
Yeah.
And, you know, his body count was known to be only 2, and there were 2 older ladies that crossed him that upset him. But just some of the darker stuff obviously didn't make the book, but just kind of weaves a rich tapestry of Wisconsin lore between the two men, Gein, and all of the forms of pop culture that he inspired, as far as Leatherface and obviously the parts with the Hannibal Lecter, the cannibalism, and also Buffalo Bill when the Silence of the Lambs film. And then, of course, the Alfred Hitchcock title, Psycho, was directly inspired by the book by Robert Bloch, who was living in Wisconsin at the time of the Gein apprehension. So he got kind of a front row seat to it, although he says, well, Norman Bates is his own character and he wasn't inspired by Gein. Definitely you can see some of Gein's thumbprints on that novel and the subsequent Psycho movie by Hitchcock.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. I mean, it is, I suppose it, when you look at cultural influences, I think sometimes people forget just how prevalent Gene was in those early days. Because as you say, Psycho came out 3 or 4 years after the Gene story had hit the headlines all across North America, and inspired it.
Yeah, from the Gene trial to the publication of the Robert Bloch novel to the production of the movie, I think it was only a few years, which is just an incredibly fast timetable for that time period.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are sometimes occasions where a book lands and it within a year or so. I mean, we're quite used to it in the modern era, Jeff, I suspect. Mm-hmm. Often books are optioned even before they hit the shelves sometimes in this modern era. But I know Rebecca, which is obviously a classic ghost story, was released in 1942, and Hitchcock, I think, optioned it within 3 months of it being released, and the film came out in 1944, I think it was. And so you look at sometimes, it's amazing how something can strike so hot very quickly and capture people, especially for somebody like Hitchcock to base another of his fascinating films that he was releasing throughout that period. Probably his zeitgeist, really. He very rarely missed a step during that period of the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, he was definitely tapped in at that time. And then the Robert Bloch novel, immediately going to film with it. And the auteur, Hitchcock, was able to kind of pull in all of his, as far as his resources, and turn around and make the film, which is just a timeless classic, and really started that killer thriller genre.
Very much so. Just even now, like you say, I mean, it's 60 odd years on, there are still scenes and the way that certain sections of that film are filmed that you would have never seen anything like that at that period. Now we're probably very used to some of the tricks that Hitchcock would use, like the camera following somebody as they fall down the stairs and the people crossing very quickly and things that have I just seen that kind of thing. And so it's fascinating how much he influenced. And like you say about Leatherface, some people don't realize it's entirely based on Gene, because obviously Gene's thing was, he was building himself a skin suit.
Yeah, maybe not the chainsaw, but definitely.
Absolutely. So I suppose when you're sitting down and you're trying to sift through some of these particular characters and legends, like we said, it's probably the hardest part is to what not include. And I think when you're aiming for that sort of, I think you're probably looking at sort of from 8 to 12, I would imagine, Jeff, for this kind of book, or maybe even earlier than 8. And depending on someone's interest in it, that kind of sort of area, that there are certain stories where I suppose when we deal with these kinds of things, we kind of become a little bit numb to some of the stranger aspects of it. And we don't sometimes realize the impact it can have on a young mind. So I suppose when you're pulling a book together that's primarily aimed at a specific age range, you've got to be really careful, because there's some great stories, but you think, how much detail am I going to include in this one? Because obviously one of the key characters in this, and to be fair, you can't really have a book about Wisconsin legends without including Dogman. I would imagine you have to be very careful about the particular version that you put there.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about, you know, Wisconsin's Dogman, known as the Beast of Bray Road or the Walworth County Werewolf, whatever you want to call him, doesn't seem to attack humans so much. Maybe, you know, there was one run-in with a motor vehicle that Linda Godfrey covered in her early work. But as far as the beast itself, it doesn't seem to attack humans. So I thought that was something that definitely needs to be included, as you said. But I kind of shied away from the scarier aspects and just kind of wanted to create a sense of wonder that there was this kind of half man, half dog creature stalking the woods of Wisconsin, and let the reader's imagination kind of fill in the blanks.
Yeah, very. I suppose as well, for you, Jeff, growing up when you did, you were there ground zero for when the Beast of Bray Road hit the headlines. I can only imagine what it must be like for a young person who's really interested in weird things to think, hang on a minute, is there a werewolf running around my state?
Yeah, it was really captivating at the time to hear the reports and then to see the magazine news programs like Inside Edition and Hard Copy kind of hit the streets of rural Wisconsin to explore the phenomenon, you know, and they kind of made a tongue in cheek lightness out of it. But to see something that Linda Godfrey published in, I think it was like December 31st of 1993, it was kind of the end of the year, slow news week. And this article comes out on the Wisconsin werewolf, and for it to hit the AP news wires and to grab the public's attention in such a way just seems just rather remarkable for that time.
I think it's, when I look at it now and I look back, it was perplexing and also extremely surprising how quickly these encounters and experiences from people in Wisconsin went all around the world. Because I remember reading about it in the 14 Times in the early 90s. Mm. And then that's when we started to get a lot of American cable shows coming over here. Cable finally started and satellite TV finally started to reach out across the United Kingdom. Because up until sort of the early to mid 90s, Jeff, we were basically just with our terrestrial four channels here. And it was only the posh people that had more than four channels. And often there wasn't a lot to watch. But as that kind of came on, the channels all increased and they were all obviously looking for programming that they could use. And obviously a lot of them were bringing programs over from the States that would be dealing with this. And Unsolved Mysteries was one of those, because over mm-hmm. here it was stuck away at 1 o'clock in the morning on one of the channels. But then when we got all the cable shows, it was on prime time for us. So a lot of us kind of only here in the UK finally discovered Unsolved Mysteries sort of the mid to early 90s. Add on top of that, we'd got the X-Files, and then we had programs like Sightings and things like that coming through, all on cable. All of a sudden, we had a whole world of weirdness that we'd never been aware of.
Yeah, and at that same time as that was hitting the streets, you know, the same year, I believe, as the first werewolf encounters, in at least in modern day times, you also had the Dahmer thing yep. hitting the news headlines. So I can only imagine what people across the pond thought. Oh my God, what is happening in Wisconsin? You have werewolves and serial killers.
Yeah, man, those Green Bay Packers fans are a strange lot. That's what we were thinking, Jeff.
And that remains true to this day.
Yeah, there's something in that cheese. Definitely, Jeff. I don't know where it is.
That's right.
So looking at this as well, I mean, the book is accompanied with some wonderful illustrations for all these legends. I love when I see books like this. Because it shows a deep level of care, because it's bright and it's fun, it's interesting. But each of the legends that you've decided to feature in this, and there are a couple that were new to me, there's a couple that have become staples of my favourites, if I have to be honest. And I know before you leave today, we will talk about Pancakes mm-hmm. from Space, Jeff.
That's
whenever
right.
I get the opportunity to do so.
One of my favorites.
So there's a real lot of love that's pouring out of the pages of this book, Jeff. I can see that you're deeply invested in creating this wonderful collection, not only for your children, but for other children all across the world. It's a beautiful book, and I love the illustrations, the Mastodon one specifically, mm. because I've always had a soft spot for the woolly mammoth or the Mastodon. And even as we sit here talking, we know that there are people beavering away around the world trying to bring them back, which is something that I still, despite the weirdness that I indulge myself in every day, I still can't get my head around.
Yeah, it's a curious one to me. And, you know, that's one thing that most people don't think of when they think of Wisconsin is the Ice Age era, and having these large, almost elephant-like creatures roaming the lands, saber-toothed tigers, woolly mammoths, mastodons. And the specific legend that you're alluding to is these mini mastodons. So there was a folk tale that cropped up in the 1950s around Richland Center. And it may have correlated to an actual historical event that happened there in 1897, a farmer on his land in Richland County, Wisconsin. Now, this would be the southwest region of Wisconsin known as the Driftless Area. Now, the Driftless Area, the interesting thing about Wisconsin's geography is everybody thinks of the rolling hills and the farm fields, which we have many. We have many dairy farms. We are America's Dairyland. But in the southwest corner of Wisconsin, there is a region called the Driftless Region. And this is the region of the country where the glacier missed, or the region of Wisconsin that the glacier missed. Oh. And it features many craggy rock formations and limestone hills and a lot of outcroppings where they passed roads through it. So it lends itself to this legend where in 1897, a man on his farm discovered the Boas mastodon, as it's called, and it was a well-preserved piece of a mastodon. So this gave rise to a story about how these mastodons actually lived in the wilds of Wisconsin. And as the food dwindled generation to generation, the mastodons got smaller and smaller. And then eventually people took them in as pets. And then due to lack of food around the Great Depression, people couldn't afford to feed their mastodon as well. So they let them free. And then eventually the mini mastodons died off. It's a great folktale, almost wholly based in fiction, but with a little bit of sprinkle of some of that Ice Age history and the discovery of the mastodon bones found within Wisconsin. I thought that was a fun little tale to include in the book.
Yeah, they are strange stories that appear about this. I mean, I've come across numerous stories in the modern era of people claiming to still encounter them in certain locations, such as Alaska and Siberia. And obviously, from what I knew as a child growing up and having a deep love of paleontology and the perception back then of when they became extinct to what we now know is that we think they lasted until about 3,000 years ago on a specific island off the coast of Alaska and Canada. It just shows you that how quickly things can change in the realms of such things as this. And as I mentioned before we dove into that, Jeff, that people are now bringing this creature back. And it's amazing how much love there seems to be for a particular prehistoric or Ice Age creature such as this. Because I know last week there was a wonderful story over here in Austria, a guy who's been renovating his wine cellar. Mm-hmm. And when they've been digging the floor up to make some more room, they found three mastodon skeletons.
Oh, my.
Under his floor, which is just remarkable.
That is remarkable.
When you think of the history and the fact that they would have had to have built there anyway, and then he's just dug a couple of feet further down than they originally did, and there they are. We've had it here recently. They were building a rail line in the south of England, and they found a tar pit with about 7 or 8 skeletons in. And you just think, gosh, were they here? I mean, I sometimes love going to museums in the UK and seeing some of, you know, we used to have hyenas wandering around the UK 10,000 years ago. So to discover some mastodons was far less surprising than discovering that hyenas wandered around Bristol so many years ago.
Yeah. And that, you know, in the entire timescale of, you know, the creation of Earth, they say it's 4 billion years. To think, if they lived till 3,000 years ago, what's saying that there might not be an extant herd of these things somewhere, like you said, in Siberia or up in Alaska or somewhere in the wilds that haven't been touched? And, you know, just kind of keeping that possibility open that, hey, maybe these things aren't completely extinct. And then also the efforts to try to bring them back. You know, I always I lean on that one quote from Jurassic Park. You know, they always thought, I can't remember the exact, but not whether we could, but as we should. Yes. Should we do this?
Well, I find it quite amusing that what they're suggesting is that they're just going to plonk them somewhere in Siberia, as if they think that these creatures are just going to go, oh, brilliant, we'll just stay here, shall we? And not like wander off to Finland or something.
Yeah, down to Russia to deal with Putin, I guess.
Yeah, as because regardless, the one thing we know about animals is they never usually stay where they're supposed to.
No.
I wouldn't like to be driving a cold night in Siberia and getting stuck between one of those crossing the road or something.
No, and we in America we have the American bison that's yes. Still, you know, they've done a good effort to bring them back in the Rocky Mountains, and you see the videos of people that you know, either get too close or actually provoke these animals. And I could only imagine what a mastodon or a woolly mammoth could do to your vehicle had you crossed it.
Absolutely. You only have to look at what an angry rhino can do to a very tough Jeep. Jeff, yes. To think something five times larger than that. Yeah, good luck there.
Yeah. Yes. We best leave the past in the past is kind of how I feel about it.
Yeah. Well, as long as it's not on my continent, I'll see how it goes, Jeff, I think.
Well, yeah, you're on an island, so I think you'll be safe unless they learn how to swim.
Hey, don't put it past them. You know, the English Channel is not deeper than Loch Ness, you know, so it's not that, true. You know, it's only about 650 feet. So it I don't think they get that big, but you never know. I'll let you know, Jeff.
Yeah, we've seen enough monster movies in our time.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. As a Harryhausen aficionado, I know not to scoff at such strange ideas.
That's right.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
I mean, one of the key legendary creatures that I love is the Hodag. And specifically, this character seems to have had a bit of a resurgence over the last sort of 20, 30 years now, Jeff, from being a throwback tale at the end of the 19th century. Wisconsin seems to have really embraced this wonderfully strange story about this creature and what it did and where it lived, to the fact that you now have this wonderful festival every year that seems to draw people in from all around the world, as a lot of these wonderful cryptid themed festivals do in the United States these days. Why do you think the state has fallen in love with the Hodag? Would you suggest that the Hodag has become the state cryptid, even though it's got some severe competition from the Beast of Bray Road these days?
Yeah, and I guess we could kind of go north south on that one, but I guess we'll kind of get into the backstory of the Hodag. The Hodag, it came from kind of the same mythical universe as Paul Bunyan and the Babe the Big Blue Ox. Mm. So apparently a Hodag was said to be born from the ashes of a cremated ox that had been treated poorly by its handlers. The cremated ox would be magically transformed into a Hodag and set free to roam the forest, specifically the forests of northern Wisconsin. And the people of Rhinelander, it was a logging community in the late 1800s, and there was a specific woodsman by the name of Eugene Shepherd. Now, he was said to have encountered this mysterious beast while hiking near his home in Rhinelander. Now, the beast, it snarled at him, and the woodsman, he retreated back to his logging camp unscathed. Well, Shepherd, he organized a hunt. And on several occasions, he even captured the beast alive. Now, the specific one was in 1893, only a few weeks before the inaugural Oneida County Fair in Rhinelander. So Shepherd was planning to display his Hodag in a darkened tent at the first ever Oneida County Fair. Now, fairgoers, they could come into the tent, leave their dime at the admission counter, and experience the beast on his own. Now, eventually, Shepherd had to admit that the whole thing was a ruse, and the darkened tent, it kind of provided cover for his misdeeds, where he had the either his sons or one of the willing participants pretend to be a growling creature, and then manipulated either burlap sacks or tarps to show that, oh, the Hodag's alive. And he even went as far as to display it in his backyard and kind of get people to come by. And Eugene Shepherd, he was lumberjack adjacent. He was what you call a timber cruiser. So somebody who went in all throughout Wisconsin's North Woods, stretching into the Northwest of America, looking for prime cuts of timber to sell to a growing lumber industry who was looking to develop that lumber into houses and as America was expanding. So he was known to visit these lumber camps and weave tales. He's a real rock on tour. I call him the P.T. Barnum of the bunkhouse, because that's the kind of character he was. And the Hodag was his biggest presentation, or what he's most well known for. Mm. Now, in modern times, Rhinelander is known as home of the Hodag. Now, I just came back from the Hodag Heritage Festival that you mentioned earlier. That was a couple weeks ago, and got to see, a lot of great friends, Ben Brunell of the Hodag Store, Carrie Bladorn of the Logging Museum in Rhinelander, and really see what they have turned this festival into, where they celebrate this beast. He appears on the water tower. He's on cop cars. His statue is in front of all the municipal buildings. The Oneida County Courthouse has him. And then the Chamber of Commerce has the largest Hodag statue in the world, where everybody can stop and take a selfie with the revered cryptid. There's a country music festival that's been going since the 70s. That is called the Hodag Festival. And in recent years, the Chamber of Commerce, with help from Carrie and Ben, have been able to put together this festival that celebrates the mythology behind the beast that we know as the Hodag.
It's an incredible sort of view into that era as well, because there are so many of these tall tales that came out of this. But the fact that he created this creature and got people to pay him, come and visit him, has always made me chuckle. And I was thinking about this last week, because obviously when we'd arranged it, and I was thinking about the Hodag, and I'd seen that footage of this zoo in China, Jeff. I don't know if you've seen this, that's got into
trouble.
Yeah,
where they took the dogs and painted them as pandas.
Yes, a couple of chow chows that they painted. I mean, they do look very cute, but people were saying that at first, suspicions weren't raised, which, when I saw the footage, I thought, how do you not think that's a dog?
You wonder, if you're told something enough and you get your imagination to be carried away, you probably can believe just about anything.
But it's not the first time. This happens fairly regularly. I know it happened about 3 years ago in another province in China, where they painted a dog black and white to resemble a panda. So there's a theme developing here.
Yeah, it seems like the trickster energy was definitely strong in Eugene Shepherd and is carried forward into some of these hoaxes of today.
Absolutely. Very much so. I mean, how much has the Hodag Festival grown over the years, Jeff? How long has it been running? Is it something that the locals have always sort of celebrated as a kind of celebration of not only the Hodag, but their history and the fact that where this community sort of came from and how it's moved forward over the years and evolved? Or has the Hodag been a constant thing, and it's only that now, in this modern era of social media, where we're able to go anywhere in the world and see what's happening, that more people from outside have become aware of the Hodag?
Yeah, so the Hodag has been the mascot for the Rhinelander high school teams, the athletic programs, for years. And festival and it's in its official capacity, I'm not certain how long that's been going on. I think it's probably been 4 or 5 years in kind of the current form. There has, throughout the years since the 70s, there's been Hodag festivals of some form other than the musical festival, because most people, when they think of, oh, I'm going to Hodag for the weekend, they know it's the music festival, at least in Wisconsin. That's so well known. So it seems like everybody knows what Hodag is, but there wasn't as much attention as far as the mythology of the Hodag and the creator, Eugene Shepherd. And if I had to say, it's almost equally a celebration of the beast as it is the creator, Gene Shepard, who he grew up in Green Bay, moved to central Wisconsin, then ended up in Rhinelander. And he's kind of, you know, the patron saint of Rhinelander, even though, you know, he was a kind of a trickster character. his lore still comes through.
Yeah. I wonder what they would think, Jeff, if they could have an insight into the future and think that 140 years later, we'd still be talking about this character and the creature he created.
I can only imagine what Eugene Shepard would think in of modern day Rhinelander, walking through and seeing all of the creature that he kind of breathed life into, so to speak.
I mean, one of the other wonderful aspects about Wisconsin is its long history of UFOs, Jeff. And before we get into one of my very favourite stories from anywhere in the world, of Joe Symington and his wonderful space pancakes, which always still makes me laugh. It's probably, you know, whenever I mention it, I can't help but chuckle about this story, even, you know, 63 years on. But Wisconsin has such a rich history. There are some incredible sightings over the years. I know one of the most important people in the history of modern ufology, Coral Lorenzen, was from Wisconsin, and she helped set up APRO, I think it was, back in the in the early days. And this was because as a child she saw a UFO before the Golden Age, so it was before the Second World War when I think Coral had her sighting. But you've got numerous things. I mean, there used to be a UFO festival, I think, for the Dundee Mountains UFO sightings, which the chap that had it, people were coming for like 30 years before he sadly passed away during the pandemic a couple of years ago.
Yeah, Mr. Bennett, he passed in 2021, I believe, and that was the final year of that. And you mentioned Coral Lorenzen. And yeah, she had her first sighting. I think she was like a 9-year-old girl in, and I want to say, yeah, that was, I'm not sure on in the exact year, but yeah, it was before the World War II era. And that really spurred her to research these things and start APRO, which eventually kind of worked its way into MUFON when she had moved to the Southwest. They started the Midwest UFO Research Organization, which eventually became the Mutual UFO Network. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so Wisconsin has a very rich history of UFO lore, and you mentioned Lorenzen, the other luminary or figurehead in the field of ufology would be Jan Hynek. And when he was getting his PhD, he was at the observatory in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, which is not too far from his home in Chicago, where he grew up and where he taught school, I believe, at the University of Chicago. So he was there. Coral Lorenzen was there. And then you mentioned Joe Symington. Do we want to get into Joe Symington now?
Well, I think why not? Why not? Because I can't talk about Joe and his pancakes enough.
Yes. So on Tuesday, April 18th of 1961, Joe Symington, he's just a plumber from Eagle River. Now, he may have entered into an intergalactic trade. It was shortly before noon on his rural property in the north woods of Wisconsin, where a saucer-shaped craft, he described it brighter than chrome. Now, he was a plumber, so I think he probably knew a thing about chrome fittings. So yes. Saying that this brilliant-looking saucer-shaped craft landing on his farm in 1961, an occupant, he peeked his head out of the craft's hatch, and then he motioned to Symington by holding up a jug. Well, the plumber thought, you know, this was the universal sign for please fill it with water. So he retrieved the pitcher, he filled the jug up, and he returned it to the ship. Now, a different occupant handed him 4 cakes after Joe kind of peered in and saw this other occupant working on what he kind of described as like a griddle. So the cakes, they were about 1/4 inch thick and 3 to 4 inches in diameter. He got 4 of them. Now, did Joe Symington, did he just receive space pancakes? The plumber said he tried one of the cakes and he said it tasted like cardboard. Now, the word got about the incident at the Symington farm, and he received countless media requests from newspapers and television programs. And Joe Symington, he resolved that the incident actually happened, but he said if it ever happened again, I don't think I'd tell anybody about it. So it's one of those stories in UFO lore that really makes you scratch your head to think, what really happened on that fateful day in 1961 to some plumber and chicken farmer in the North Woods of Wisconsin? Something that ever since I heard it, I just am befuddled and baffled. And after enough work in this field, you know, there's not many things that really grab your attention and just make you shake your head. But just seeing who was involved with it, with J. Allen Hynek and later Jacques Vallée writing about it and talking about it, to think that one of the most monumental, trace element cases or trace, I'm not sure what you want to call it, the occupants leaving something of physical, tangible means to a farmer, what to make of that. It's just it's a wild story and one that you'd be loath to even make up.
Well, this is the thing. I think when we talk about tangible evidence of contact, Jeff, I don't think people would have thought pancakes would be amongst it. But it's one of the best. This is the thing about this particular case, like you say, because of the people that were involved in it, Blue Book came up. They, mm-hmm. You know, the pancakes were studied.
yes.
Which is even more baffling. And yet, Symington was very matter-of-fact about this. I know the only thing he ever said was, if it happened again, I wish I'd never told everybody about it. Even because I think, like you say, it's such a strange story that beggars belief that you have to think, why on earth would anybody do that? Even so, like you say, just a humble plumber from Eagle River, just going about his day, who ends up lending a hand to some intergalactic visitors who are having saucer trouble, it would seem. And so it's one of the weirdest UFO stories. I mean, there are some very odd ones, but this is, for me, there's something quite sweet about it, as well as the fact that it's very strange, because occasionally we'll hear of strange things and people being given gifts or told something, or we'll find markings where they've landed or perhaps even crashed in certain cases. But this one, where we're having some kind of intergalactic food swap, seems to be quite unique in the annals of ufology, Jeff.
Yeah, and it almost kind of strays into that fairy realm or fae folk mythology, with kind of receiving these cakes or food from the fairies. Now, it said if you take food while you're in the fairy realm, you can risk being trapped there. But it seems like the whatever it was that visited Symington that day came to him on his terms. He didn't venture into theirs. So maybe that's why he wasn't abducted. And it seems like he had a pleasant encounter with the occupants, who only spent a few minutes on the ground and gave him something of value that he exchanged for something of his own. Mm. So it's really weird how that crosses streams with that. And the Jacques Vallée, who I mentioned earlier, calls it the Magonian aspect to the situation, the encounter.
Is it surprising that this story has stuck around for so long? Or do you think it's because it's unique and quite nice and a bit strange that here we are, as we say, Jeff, 63 years on from it, that it seems to be one of those cases that you can't talk about UFOs in Wisconsin without talking about Joe and his pancakes?
Yeah, it seems like that is the most prevalent one that I come across in my research for, you know, Wisconsin UFO encounters is this one. And I think it's just because it is that is so bizarre that we can't quite make heads or tails of it.
Yeah. Well, talking of strange stories, another one that really made me chuckle, or should I say cluckle, is this wonderful story about these ghost chickens. Now, I love strange stories about animal ghosts, and I know when I've spoken to Chad previously, we've spoken about strange ghost elephants that are sometimes seen.
Yes.
Which kind of leads back to mastodons as well. Who knows, they might be shaved mastodons that people are seeing. They're not actually elephants, Jeff, you never know. This story about the ghost chickens really made me chuckle, and that's not including the couple of punchlines that you put in there.
Yeah, I really had a lot of fun writing this one. So why did the ghost chicken cross the road to get to the other side? So we have to go to the northeast part of the state near everybody's favorite football team, the Green Bay Packers, outside of Green Bay. It's a little place called Chicken Alley, and it's near Seymour, which is actually the home of the hamburger. So if I had to make another one, I definitely would put the creation of the hamburger coming from Wisconsin as well. Mm. Now, this little alley is known to be home to ghost chickens. That's right, phantom fowl. Now, many motorists have come upon a flock of chickens clogging up the roadway. The chickens, they're nearly see-through, and if approached or accidentally hit, the chickens mysteriously vanish. Now, there's also a foolish dare that's been associated with Chicken Alley. It said that if you stand at the intersection of Chicken Alley and Shady Road, an unseen voice will yell, "Get out of the road." Now, I ask readers, would you take this dare on? No? What are you, chicken? So the spectral fowl phenomenon has been one that definitely intrigues me.
It's an interesting story, this, as well, because you've got this weird aspect to it that this seems to have been reported quite a lot. And it's quite a specific thing for people to see. They're not reporting seeing birds, they're saying they're seeing chickens. And you've aspects of them being almost see-through, coupled with this legendary dare, which I would not be surprised to discover if Chad's found himself stood in the middle of this road.
I believe he has.
Or if he sent Joe Turi in as his stunt double, as he often does.
His guinea pig.
Test subject, something like that. Yes,
that's right.
Because they seem to be two different things going on here. Because why? Because we can only suggest that it's not the chickens shouting "Get out the road." Is it the chicken farmer? Is that what causes people to be shouted at? I don't know. How long's this been reported for, Jeff?
That has been unknown. I know it's been a local legend for decades, but as far as the first encounter, I haven't been able to track down exactly where or when it came from. And that seems to be kind of the through line of a lot of these things, is we're not sure exactly who started it or where it started, you know, other than obviously the aforementioned the Hodag legend. We can kind of get a grasp on that. But as far as this one, we're not really sure.
What is it about Wisconsin having strange animal connections to strange stories? There's all sorts of things going on here, like we say, with chickens, elephants, dog men. What else is there?
You know, that's funny. You know, I think of where Wisconsin really got weird was with our mound building culture. There was a predating, you know, any European inhabitation of Wisconsin. We had this rich tapestry on our land of effigy mounds. Now, these mound building people, we believe they are the ancestors of one of the local tribes here, the Ho-Chunk. And they enchanted the land with these animal-like effigy mounds, these built-up mounds. And this depicted their cosmology. Could maybe their depiction of these animals imbued this on the land? That I'm not sure of, but it's a good a theory as any.
Yeah. It is surprising sometimes where you'll have certain areas that are more welcoming to certain other types of strange phenomenon, like you say. I mean, obviously, I was shocked to discover last year about the amount of hellhound or black dog sightings in North America, Jeff. That I just didn't, whether it's just presumption or there hadn't really been enough written about it for me to realize it, but I was not aware of some of the trucker lore about seeing a black dog on the road. And they're very distinct that they're talking about black dogs, and I think a lot of people tend to think that that's traditionally a British tale or folklore. Obviously, there are numerous, well, hundreds of alleged encounters across the British Isles with strange large dogs, and yet they're very prevalent all over the United States as well, which was something I found deeply surprising. So I think it's often amazing that in the modern era, because of authors such as yourself and the work you do in regards to the other legends of your particular state and other people that work in other states, how many of these wonderful, strange stories we would have lost if it wasn't for the influence of social media and video on demand these days, where we can basically go on YouTube and find out about any particular state's strange history these days.
Yeah, it's really great. You know, I like to collect a lot of the old books and do a lot of my research through them, and then also cross search with a library archives to find a lot of these weird tales. But it isn't until like the modern era where a lot of these anthology volumes are put together, a lot of the stuff that Chad Lewis does, where he goes to a specific region and pulls out of the lore, a lot of the lore, and then kind of archives it, for lack of a better term, into his books and his work, which is a great way to pass it down through the ages. And then the modern method has been social media. And that's kind of where I got my start with this was, I'd collected these books and these legends and, you know, had Evernote files of all of these things. And I thought, well, I need to share these with other people for them to get the satisfaction that I have out of it. So that's where I started Badgerland Legends on Instagram and then subsequently Facebook, and where I can pretty much go out and take one of these legends that I learned and kind of twist it and turn it and use my own voice to breathe a little new life into some of these older legends, whether, you know, it's the stuff we talked about with cryptid encounters, or if it's a haunted house, or even just a legendary figure or character that came out of Wisconsin, like Frank Lloyd Wright or Orson Welles, and kind of the impact that they had on broader culture. So that's been a fun journey for me to partake in this, to really take the magic of place, specifically my home, and do the digger deeping, the deeper digging, and really share that with the broader world, as well as Wisconsinites as a whole.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
I mean, as I said earlier, it was probably difficult of deciding what to leave out. And obviously, I don't want to ruin any more of the wonderful subjects that you touch on. You've got some very interesting facts about food history that I wasn't aware of. And you mentioned it earlier. I didn't realize the hamburger originated in Wisconsin either. So you've once again educated me, Jeff. So thank you for that. But obviously, there are some darker things that you couldn't include in this book, obviously due to the age it's aimed at. And one of my favorite, if it could be covered such a thing, from Wisconsin is obviously the Haunches, Jeff. Now, who or what and why are the Haunches? What happened?
So when I was getting into writing about Wisconsin lore and all the wonders, I had probably written, you know, 300 or 400 at the time. And I kind of asked myself one day, well, what is my favorite? And at the time I asked that question, I settled on one. And it was the Haunches of Haunchyville. Now, Wisconsin is well known for its circus history. We have Baraboo, Wisconsin, which was ground zero for the Ringling's Northern Encampment. There's Circus World Museum there today that anybody can visit. There is Al Ringling Theater. There's the Al Ringling Mansion right there just outside of the Wisconsin Dells, the world famous Wisconsin Dells. And then down in the southeast region, Werewolf Country, not too far from Bray Road, is Delavan. That was another bustling circus community. So for this legend that I'm about to tell you come out of Wisconsin really didn't come as a surprise to me. So it said that in the 1950s, a group of circus workers with dwarfism, they were displeased by the treatment of the ringmaster. They revolted against him, torturing the ringmaster by sawing off his limbs and hanging him. Now you probably know why Paul said it didn't make the book. Now, to avoid punishment from the law, they fled to the backwoods of Wisconsin and started their own colony. Now, the rumored place is a place called Mystic Drive. So it's right there in the name, Mystic Drive in Muskego. Now, this is a small community out just outside of, I think, northwest of Milwaukee. Now, the circus dwarves, for lack of a better name, were very protective of their new village, which they called Haunchyville, and trespassers be damned. Now, one day, a young boy with albinism wandered into the encampment. Now, due to his diminutive size and possibly his inability to fit in due to his skin condition, they took him in and made him one of their own. The boy, he's now a grown man. He's very protective of his adoptive community. Now, he is said to wander the woods wielding a shotgun or axe to ward off any trespassers. Now, you can visit Mystic Drive. It's only about 20 minutes from Milwaukee. And this once secluded drive is now developed with expansive estates flanking both sides of the road, really large estates on ample acreage with mansions. And then you get to the end of the drive, there is a metal post holding two signs, private drive, keep out, and no trespassing. Now, that's supposedly where these haunchies lived or once lived. Now, could the colony still be there? That seems like it's been thoroughly refuted and not much to make of the original legend. But through some digging, I know me and my podcast partner, Mike Huberty, we covered the haunchies on our Wisconsin Legends podcast called Haunchyville. And Mike was actually able to visit the haunchies, and he had quite a terrifying and comical encounter that he recounts on that podcast episode. So I'd recommend, if you want to learn more about the haunchies of Haunchyville and kind of some historical basis behind where the legend originated, to check that out. It's be well worth your time.
I mean, is there any particular legend that we've not spoken about, or perhaps is not as well known as some of the more famous residents living in the Badger State, Jeff, that you think more people should know about? Because obviously sometimes the great stories can often be overlooked by something being on trend, as it were, but is there any particular favorites that you have that more people should know about, perhaps?
So one of the most popular attractions in Wisconsin is a little tiny place called Devil's Lake. And it's said that in the 1970s, a group of Crowleyan magicians with a K had done a ritual at that lake. And they tried to pull through a Cthulhu-like creature into that body of water. Now, I find that to be quite ironic, because dating back to the days of the Native American inhabitants of Devil's Lake, there has been stories of a lake monster within that. And a kind of a personal legend that I've been told, or that I grew up with, is that Devil's Lake is a bottomless pit. Now, according to a quick Google search, we know that Devil's Lake depths somewhere around 63 or 64 feet. So it's not a very deep body of water. It's not a very big body of water. In fact, there is a prohibition against motorized or gas-powered boats on there. It's a no-wake lake. So this tiny little lake, which is a huge flock for tourists due to a lot of the scenery, the hiking, the picnicking, and just numerous acres for people to explore for, you know, a nominal cost. It's very popular. But to read about this Crowleyan magician, this ceremony or sacrament or ritual that they performed at the lake was quite intriguing, in how it kind of ties in to the depth of that. And we actually did a full episode on Devil's Lake for the Wisconsin Legends podcast, where we go into the deeper meanings of that ritual. And not a lot of people know about that. So that was fun to kind of discover and talk about that more thoroughly.
That is quite unusual, isn't it? What drew them there, if this story is to believe then, Jeff? Because you would not suspect, you would expect, due to all the history to do with Crowley and his influence around the world, that if anybody was going to try and conjure a creature up near a body of water, they'd all be encamping around Loch Ness, obviously, as he used to live up there in Bolskin House.
So there is an author. He is well known in the Four Tim realms. His name's August Derleth. Now, he is best known for perpetuating the works of H.P. Lovecraft. Now, if it wasn't for August Derleth, who is a resident or was a resident of Sauk County, Wisconsin, not too far from where Frank Lloyd Wright grew up, he is the one who really created the Cthulhu mythos. And he believed in these areas of, I guess it would be, areas of high strangeness or incredible power, and he called them Cthulhu power zone. Now, he assumed that these zones held a focused energy that can transfer mere mortals into angels or demons, or be a place where people could conjure these Cthulhu-like, kind of the old gods or the old ones from the H.P. Lovecraft idea to the fore. And that's kind of where Derleth grew up, not too far from Devil's Lake. Devil's Lake is in Sauk County. He grew up in Sauk County. And if you travel the highway there, you can be from Hawk's Place, where Arkham House did its publishing behind Derleth's leadership, to Devil's Lake within probably 20 or 25 minutes on modern roads. So it created the perfect setting for this ritual. To think Sauk County, H.P. Lovecraft, August Derleth, Cthulhu power zones, and then Crowleyan sex magic rituals being done at this lake.
Oh, it's strange how these things fall sometimes.
Yeah, it's just uncovering that one and kind of going into depth. I know Mike, he did a lot of research on that one and was able to find, I believe it was an old Kenneth Grant book where he talked about the actual ritual that was done by one of the magicians to try to pull that Cthulhu-like creature through the veil into Devil's Lake. Now, whether there's been modern sightings, I haven't heard, but there has been long-told Indian tales or early settlers' tales of a lake monster within this small lake called Devil's Lake. Very ominous name.
Yes. I mean, that's one of the things that surprises me about certain locations around North America, that you've got so many of these places named after the devil or Diablo or whatever, that seems to have got its name because people think it's a strange location, or people have strange encounters there. And here we have another one that seems to have joined the gang.
Yeah, it just adds to the rich tapestry, which is Wisconsin weirdness.
You can say that again, Jeff. So what's next for you, my friend? Has this book given you a thirst to create something perhaps for a more mature audience, or to, as we've touched on a couple of the darker aspects of Wisconsin legend, something that would be able to sort of sate your appetite in regards to some of these darker and deeper mysteries the state has?
Yeah, with my short attention span, it's been great just collecting and transmitting these stories day over day. But, you know, as the days and the years wear on, I look at kind of the totality of the work I created and think, well, there are a few things that I definitely want to dig deeper into, whether it's, you know, the Devil's Lake stuff or the Joe Simonton stuff definitely needs to be explored further. And that's something that has always been kind of in the back of my mind, that there needs to be a proper treatment of that incident and kind of put that together and put something out that tells the whole story. Because it's pretty easy to be dismissive about, okay, a ship dropped off pancakes. But when you actually look at the players behind there, whether it was I believe the U.S. Air Force even inquired about it, and just kind of digging in deeper to, hey, what did they actually find when they tested these, and who was involved, and what happened to the cakes, and where does that legend stand today? I think that definitely deserves a deeper treatment.
Definitely. So for your itinerary over the summer, are you off to any festivals? Do you have any speaking engagements coming up, Jeff?
I always have the Milwaukee Paracon as the kind of the kickoff to the spooky season. And that's actually going to happen in the heart of October this year. I have a few family excursions in mind, one to Door County, Wisconsin, which is a spooky place in its own. It's kind of the Cape Cod of Wisconsin, but it has a little creepier vibe to it. Mm. So whenever I travel, have a young family, I always try to kind of sneak off and take a picture or two, or do a little research, or pick up a local brochure. So that's definitely on the docket, and then definitely add that to my Instagram.
Brilliant. And obviously encourages the children to do their research and be prepared for whatever dad throws at them.
That's right. I kind of want to imbue them with the sense of wonder, you know, hence the Wisconsin Legends for Kids book, and kind of get them to think different about, you know, where they are in the world and what might be lurking in the shadows, or what might have happened before they got here. So one other place that we always try to get to every year is Old World, Wisconsin, which is a kind of a museum, I would say, where they collect a lot of the old buildings from different eras of Wisconsin's history and display them there. And the kids kind of get to have a peek. You know, I grew up in the 80s, before the time of cell phones or the internet. So I'm kind of old fashioned in that way. So they can see how it really was to live. And, you know, we'll feel really old when they have museums dedicated to us and our upbringing, won't we, Paul?
Yeah. I often wonder how some children would react when they see their parents have a sad look on their face when they see a phone box or something like that. Yeah.
Yes. if they don't watch Doctor Who or the old Supermans, they probably won't get the reference. But yeah. Yeah. It's not every day that you get to see an old phone booth.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've got a wonderful old one that was preserved here in Sheffield next to the town hall, which is ironically next to the old public toilets, which have now become a very sought after bar, which shows whether we will always try and put a pub anywhere we can here in Britain. Jeff, previous occupiers are no object to what a building can be in regards to, let's just turn it into a pub. So nothing surprises that. But I went to Bronte Country at the on Friday, and went and visited where the Bronte sisters grew up and the area there, which was first time I've ever had a chance to get to Haworth. So it was fascinating. But over here, there's quite a few phone boxes that have now become sort of garden ornaments, that people have placed them in their gardens. And you've got the bright red British telephone boxes as part of their garden displays.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. Well, in Wisconsin, our garden ornaments are bathtub Madonnas. Are you aware of those?
No. What's a bathtub Madonna?
So they take an old clawfoot tub and they turn it so it creates like a dome shape, and then they place the Virgin Mother within there and have a kind of a shrine to Mother Mary. And that's a very Wisconsin thing. Now, it's said that it came over amongst early Sicilian immigrants of Kenosha and Racine counties. So that would be the county south of Milwaukee County. Now, after many bathroom remodels, many crafty Wisconsinites repurposed their discarded porcelain tubs as grottos honoring the Virgin Mother. Some are outfitted with masonry. A lot of people put tiles or lights or even water features within them. Now, other pithy names given to this are Mary in a Half Shell, or the bathtub version. So let's just, instead of telephone boxes, we use bathtubs and make shrines. A lot of rich Catholic history through Wisconsin.
Oh, fabulous. Yeah, it's strange how certain areas will just grab onto something that completely sets them apart. No, I didn't. I presumed it would be something to do with how you described it, but not how it was set up. So I presume they turn the baths vertical and then...
Yes, vertical to create like a dome.
Brilliant, brilliant. I think the Vatican City are missing a trick there. I didn't see one of them when I went to Rome the last time. So keep my eye out, Jeff.
I don't think they're as kitschy in Rome and the Vatican City as we are in Wisconsin. Oh, and that's probably a good thing.
I wouldn't know. You should see what they sell on the stalls there.
I have not had the pleasure, but can only imagine.
It's one of those strange things. You go to sometimes these countries and you'll be amazed. It's like Greek has a strange thing about phallic symbols being available on every at every store. You can buy any shape, size or color of a phallic symbol on these stalls. And they're everywhere, you know, with wings and all sorts. I don't know what's going on there, Jeff.
some kind of repressed issues going down there.
Well, yeah, some throwback to the old Greek history, I think, that has eluded me despite my love of Greek mythology. So
that's great.
So, Jeff, thank you so much for joining me today. Where can everybody follow your work, keep on up to date with everything else you've got going on, and follow your and Mike's podcast?
Yes, at Badgerland Legends on Instagram as well as Facebook is the best way to connect with me. Badgerlandlegends.com, WisconsinLegendsPodcast.com, Wisconsin Legends Podcast on all of your podcatchers, including Spotify. We'll get you right there. And I hope to hear from much of your audience.
Lovely. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes for everybody and where they can get a hold of the copy of the book.
Yes, Wisconsin Legends for Kids on Amazon.
And once again, congratulations on a beautiful and thought-provoking book. It's brilliant and one that all kids who love a bit of the strange should get involved in. Obviously, as an honorary Wisconsinite, I want my state to promote it to the young children as often as we can and get our future generations prepared for encountering a dog man or a hodag on their travels.
That's Jeff. Right.
And so I salute your diligent work in preparing them for these dangers ahead.
Sounds great. Thanks so much for having me, Paul.
It's been a pleasure to finally have you on, Jeff. You take care, and hopefully we'll speak again in the future, my friend.
Likewise. Take care.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right Rug.